This is Merlin Mann, and I am the editor of 43folders.com. You're listening to Productive Talk, a series of conversations I recently had with David Allen near his offices in Ojai, California. As you probably know, David Allen is a speaker, coach, consultant, and of course, he's the author of the best-selling book, Getting Things Done. David's GTD methodology is the foundation for all the work that the David Allen Company has brought to thousands of people internationally. And it never goes without saying that David's work has been a tremendous influence on 43 Folders, so I was really thrilled to get the chance to sit down and chat with him. The file you're listening to right now is a compilation of the 8 podcast episodes of Productive Talk, which ran on 43folders.com and davidco.com in the fall of 2006. The approximate total running time is 1 hour and 30 minutes, so grab a sandwich. Anyway, we hope you enjoy the show, and we do thank you very much for stopping by. Episode 1, Procrastination.
So one of the things that comes up on 43 Folders all the time, this is something that this is an evergreen topic, the whole idea of procrastination. And people saying, look, I've done getting things done. I feel like I know all the things that I need to do, but for some reason, this pile is just growing, and I'm having trouble even knowing where to turn at a given point. And so I have the sense that this, for you, might indicate some kind of a problem in the system. I'm just curious what you think about the whole idea of procrastination. How do you help people with that?
Well, I'll tell you how I deal with it. The whole idea is to give yourself a whole lot of really, really constructive things to do as a way to avoid the really real things you need to be doing. For instance, the prettier my house looks, the more you know there is some humongous project I am avoiding. So as long as you're going to waste time, you might as well have a big range of things you can go procrastinate with that actually are reasonably good things to do. So there's my first tip, is just make sure you've got reasonably healthy things as a way to avoid the stuff you really don't want to go do. So there's one, you know, trick out of the box. Now, that's only for advanced graduate people. I don't usually share that with other people, but Merlin, you're special. So thought I'd share that with you and your crew. But, you know, come on, I can riff about procrastination quite a bit. There's a lot of different factors going on there.
And so this is really one role, though, of the natural planning model. It's just the whole idea of being able to choose the kind of task that accords with your priority, time, energy, context, and so on. Is that a part of finding the kind of task that's going to work best at a given time?
Well, look, I'm going to jump right to a real bottom line on this, and I have to attribute. And I'm sorry, the author's name escapes me, but The War of Art, fabulous book. And basically, it's an artist, a writer, who got down to the bottom line that the thing that is closest to your soul is the thing you're going to avoid the most. The thing that will tap into the thing, part of you that has not yet come to the fore but wants to be expressed, but you're so afraid of it, you will absolutely find every single thing in your life to avoid doing that. And that one, there is no trick about that one. You just need to be aware of that. I think the awareness is somewhat curative. And if you're really aware that probably the things you're going to avoid the most are the things that are going to scare you the most, that you might have to actually show up, you know, if that thing actually worked and if it actually uncorked. Now, that said, I just needed to say that because that's going to be an underlying groundswell on all of these things that is only going to be addressed by your willingness to step up to the plate, you know, with some of those deeper and more awesome kinds of things we all have to grapple with at some point in our lives. So let's not kid ourselves. That's a real driver. However, given that, you want every trick in the book to make it as easy as possible to give yourself permission to step into those things. So let's back it up to the GTD process. I mean, a lot of that, medium weight level about procrastination, I think people avoid it avoid things for two reasons. The outcome is not meaningful enough to you, meaning, you know, you keep telling yourself to do something, but frankly, it's past its timing. You know, my first question to people who are avoiding something, I say, look, excuse me, have you really rethought that? Is that something you really want to do? Because it could be that your inner process has already moved past that thing. You've still got old momentum on it. It's still on your project list. You haven't gotten, you know, stepped up to the plate and said, excuse me, that's a someday maybe. Or dump it. Timing's past. So I think that's the first thing is, look, is this thing still meaningful to you? Now, the truth is a lot of those really are still meaningful to you. And then the only other reason that you'll avoid it is because you don't feel confident that you can engage with control and success. And so engaging with control and success, that actually backs up to the bigger thing that I mentioned before. That's one of the things you're saying, gee, if I step into who this I really am, I don't know if I can control that because it's so much bigger than me and I'm not used to it. So that's at a deeper or higher level of sense of loss of control. Down on a more tactical level, if you haven't figured out what the next action is, there's a big void. You know, if you say, gee, I need to handle dad and elder care, but I don't want to think about it right now, it's because some part of you says, I don't know what's next. You know, and I don't have the energy to think and decide, as a subliminal part of you says, there's thinking a decision that's going to be required to figure out whether that's next a phone call. So if you can jump ahead and trick yourself to figure out what's the very next action step I can take on this, then you've finished your thinking. And then you got a widget to crank. And widgets are a lot easier to crank than to figure out what widgets to crank.
That's right. There's a book we talk about a lot on the site that I think I've mentioned to you a little in the past, a book called The Now Habit by Neil Fiore. And it's a terrific book on how to deal with procrastination and kind of taking a sideways approach to the more typical way of saying work harder, knuckle down. And one of the things that he talks about a lot is the ability to create a sense of security for yourself, to create a sense of kind of a net. And he uses the metaphor of imagine walking across a plank that's 6 inches off the ground versus a plank that's, 30,000 feet off the ground, and how that kind of impacts the way that you think about having to deal with that. And so I think next action is key into that sort of idea very much. Like you say, you kind of firewall into one mode the whole thinking process so that when it's time to do, you're not having to doubt yourself and wonder if you're going to be able to do it at all, because now you know you can. You know it's the next physical thing that you can do.
Sure. I mean, people, they often, one of my big keys is to sort of get your life back to widgets again. You know, if you show up, you've got one of those widget cranking jobs, and I had tons of them, growing up, crank a widget. You know, you show up, there's a big pile of uncranked widgets next to a widget cranking machine. I mean, it's not real confusing what to do when you're not sitting there going, oh, God, I don't know if I can crank the widget. It's like it's there. It's obvious. You've cranked a zillion of them before. So you step in and you do it. Now, you might be bored, but you're not procrastinating. Right. So you at least have a widget to crank. And the whole idea is anything in your life comes down to a widget. It's just, and if you haven't finished the thinking to get it down to the widget level about what it means, I don't care how weird, strange, ambiguous, awesome, lofty, or whatever this thing is that you got banging around in there, if you actually want to get something done, it actually is going to have to ultimately translate to pick up phone, punch number, boot computer, hit key, open mouth, walk right in store, buy nail. So ultimately it's going to come down to some widget to crank, and once you get it down to boot computer, damn, I can do that. But back to your point, I think it's also true that in our culture, just the whole idea of mind mapping, or being willing to have an idea before it's good and see it.
Not judging it.
Yeah, and not having to have it right. Mm-hmm. We all had Mrs. Williams in the fourth grade that before you write something, it damn well better be good, because we stared at Roman numeral 1 and had blood, ooze out of our forehead.
Right.
Trying to figure out what was going to be the right thing to write down. So permission to make wrong decisions, permission to give yourself the freedom, that's that security net that you and he mentioned. How do I create security? Well, one way to create security is don't worry about screwing up.
That's right. There's an author that I like a lot named Annie Lamott that lives up in the Bay Area, and she has she calls it the shitty first draft. And she says it's very key to me in my process that I give myself permission to write a completely awful first draft of anything, that I'm basically a child scribbling on a page, and I give myself permission to do that. And I may not use any of it. But the fact is, I've gotten it all out there, and now I have something to start with. And I may take one little kernel of that and turn it into something that's a second draft. But like I say, you give yourself permission to not have to be perfect that first time out of the box. And that security is in place.
And Merlin, here's a GTD spin on that one, too. We spent thousands of hours with some of the best, brightest, and busiest people on the planet, all of whom procrastinate. So if anybody's worried out there that they're the lone stranger, it's like, yeah, you're right. But one of the best tricks that GTD can teach you is how to define a process project. In other words, gee, I don't know what to do about this merger or acquisition opportunity. I don't know what to do about this whole thing about mom and dad and where we're going to, that they're into elder care mode, or I don't know what to do, whatever the weird thing out there that you know you need to be doing something about. And what a lot of people do is they say, well, I'm not going to do anything because I need to decide what to do before I can do anything. Whereas if they made it a project called figure out or find out what my options are.
Or to say even draft three ideas for how to handle this.
Yeah, but even the project on that, I've got a big project. I'm going to research whether there's anything I care or want to do about this called R&D. That's why you look at my project list, you're going to see a bunch of R&D, shorthand for look into. So the willingness to even identify that look into is actually a very solid little project. And what's the next thing to look into? I don't know. Pick up the phone, punch seven numbers at random, whoever answers, say, hey, you know anything about, you know? So you're going to have a widget to crank about something that you can then start to feel successful. I'm at least starting to find out. And most people haven't acknowledged that their process is as much their work as anything else. And those process projects, those are big keys.
Absolutely, especially for the knowledge workers out there. I'm curious, something in discussions we've had, it seems clear to me that a lot of what, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in another segment, but it's clear to me that a lot of the times when people are having these kind of these problems like procrastination, it seems like you seem to feel that a lot of times that indicates some kind of leak in the system, or there's some place, there's some piece of the five stages of this where something's not getting done, maybe frequently the review. I'm curious, specifically with regard to procrastination, what kind of leaks do you think that indicates in the system, and where can people be patching that?
Boy, it could come from anywhere, Merlin. I mean, you could take them one at a time. If you haven't collected everything you know you need to collect, there's a part of you that's going to avoid thinking that's the right thing to do. And so you've automatically got a leak. You've automatically got static.
If you haven't captured it all,
if you haven't captured it all, and you don't even know that this is the whole inventory, it'll give you the greatest little avoidance mechanism. I mean, one way to stop procrastinating is to plug up all the leaks in terms of where you might let yourself rabbit trail. In other words, it's one of the best tricks in the world is don't give yourself, you know, things to that are very easy to get into that'll very easily let you avoid what you're doing. And one of the more subtle things about that is to some part of you know not everything is in this system. So there might be something more important than this. So I'm going to let myself off the hook and not focus on it. You know, it's kind of the hard news. It's well, excuse me, once you get it all out and you're looking at it all, that's it. And if you decide to not do something else, then it needs to, you know, there's a part of you that says, am I willing to step up to that plate and say, okay, that is now the most important thing to do. So, you know, people just tend to go somewhat numb about the whole game until the whole system's there. So step one, if you haven't collected everything, you're likely to do it. Step two, have you processed all the stuff you've collected? That's one of the biggest, if you have anything on your desk that's in a stack, you're procrastinating. You know, there's anything that you haven't decided what exactly you're going to do about it, but some part of you knows you should be deciding what exactly you should be doing about it. You're in procrastination mode.
So part of what you're saying is that it's maybe not accurate to frame procrastination as something that only happens in the fifth part, being the doing part of it. That in fact, the procrastination is actually happening in a different part of your brain and a different part of the system, because any part of that could have a leak.
Absolutely. Well, you know,
if you haven't decided what you want to do with it, then there's no way you can actually turn that into an action.
Procrastination actually just means it's not about not doing, it's about not doing and feeling crappy, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, you can either feel really good that what we're doing right now, talking to each other, you know, with these two microphones in front of us, is exactly what you and I need to do on the planet in terms of our life, purpose, destiny, and all that stuff, or it's not. If it's not, then you're going to be in some level of procrastination, meaning you're not feeling good that what you're doing is what you need to be doing. There's probably something else you should be doing. So you may be procrastinating about thinking about what you should be doing.
Episode 2, Patching Leaks.
Well, in another segment, we talked a little bit about procrastination, and we talked about how procrastination has a role in kind of helping you track down some of the holes in your system and where things leak. Something that you have said from the very beginning, since I've been aware of getting things done, is that this is really kind of a whole cohesive system, and you choosing to do it in a buffet way can lead to a lot of problems because all the pieces kind of fit together in a certain way. Furthermore, it sounds like a lot of times you are able to help people track down specific kinds of problems they're having by looking at where those leaks seem to be and where things are falling short. So I want to talk a little bit about ways to patch that system, ways to find those holes, how you take those, if you will, symptoms and figure out where those holes are and then patch them up.
Sure, let's do that. I mean, and I can tell you right away that if you're feeling absolutely, absolutely in your gut comfortable about that what you're doing is what you need to be doing, then you're on. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, there's something you then need to do to get yourself back to that on space. So that can take on a lot of different characteristics or a lot of different places that that can happen. So,
is the secret answer to this frequently that it's time to do a review?
The secret answer is if you still got stuff on your mind, there's stuff you haven't done yet that you need to do to get stuff off your mind.
But where is the entry point for that? If I'm sitting here and I feel a lot of, I'm feeling a lot of anxiety about, like you say, the stuff I'm not doing, which I would take that as a symptom. Yeah. That's a symptom you feel comes up a lot. People
Absolutely.
Feeling it's the whole sort of split attention. Where I feel like I don't even know what to get started on because I know there's 50 things I need to. I talked to a guy the other day about this, a guy I'm helping with some of his productivity stuff. And he's got a kind of a sales job where he's got a lot of parallel projects that have the same basic kind of sales tunnel to all of them. And it's the same process over and over. They're all in slightly different places. But if he's got 60 of these and he doesn't even know where to begin, you know, in his case, for example, what kind of leak would that be for you?
Yeah, well, it's tough to say. Sometimes the leak is because there isn't even a system to clean up. And so, you know, that's the big leak. It's called your psyche.
And that's the problem with the buffet.
That's the problem with the buffet. And, you know, I'm really of two minds about this, Merlin. I mean, being 60 and old and cranky, you know, as I've gotten older and crankier, there's a part of me that says, look, if you're not willing to make this a complete, total, whole system you get back to regularly, don't bother doing any of it because it's too much trouble. Mm-hmm. Because now I'm trying to keep a system up, but I don't feel really good about that because it's extra work and I know it's not complete. So my head's still, I'm still being driven by latest and loudest out of my head. So, oh, damn. Well, I go, well, why don't you just give it up and go home and just be, you know, and just do what you feel like doing. So one or the other. I mean, either your head is the place to hold this or it's not. I mean, somebody try to tell me halfway in between and rationalize it. There is no way you can do that. You know, either your head is your system or it's not. So that's the biggest hole, is that people are still trusting their psyche for options and opportunities and keeping track of the inventory of what their commitments are as opposed to their head. Now, where that leak could be, it could be in any one of the five phases. And it could also be in that I've collected, processed, and organized everything down on this level, but I got some 30,000 or 40,000 foot stuff in impinging on me right now. You know, my spouse just came and told me they're thinking about a career change, but that's going to mean we're both going to have to move. And what is that going to deal with? And so that's impinging on me. So I don't feel comfortable now even about all my mundane stuff because I got this 40,000 foot thing on my head that I haven't sat down, grappled with it, decided what I'm going to do, decided what the next step was.
And it doesn't feel, it's something I'm one of those people who's guilty of spending a lot more time with the first third of the book than the second two thirds. Really, just another way of saying very fake. Focused on the tactical, as you say, runway view of things.
Come on, that's appropriate. That's why we start there, is because that's where most people's attention is. But if you stop there, you have not done GTD.
Well, that's what's interesting, is I went back and reread some of the last few chapters, and something that I had a little bit of an aha moment about was realizing the ways in which if you're not capturing that stuff at these higher levels. And for the people who aren't super familiar with this, the basic model of GTD just involves kind of starting with the things that are what you call runway items, which are the sort of tasks and things. That leads you to what he calls a 10,000 foot view of projects, and so on further up through your 1 year goals and all the way up to the things that like explain your existence on Earth. And the thing that I finally got, I think, is the idea that if you're not capturing the kinds of things that are on your mind at those higher levels, there's still just as much as not answering an email is going to claim parts of your attention. Not thinking about, you know, if there's a part of your mind that really is thinking a lot about what your role on Earth is, if you're not finding a way to spend some time on that, then that's going to continue to eat away. And you're not going to feel like you've captured everything completely.
Exactly.
The leaks can happen at every level, height and width-wise.
Sure. And in a way, but, you know, the funny kind of paradox about GTD is, yes, indeed, you need to then start to be aware of the more subtle things that have your attention. But it's all about, well, what has your attention?
Things that are so obvious.
You know, and I'm not telling you what should have your attention. Isn't that nice?
That is nice.
I'm just asking you, what has your attention? It's just that anybody listening to this, if I said, what has your attention right now, give me the top five things, very few people are going to say, fulfill destiny as human spirit on planet. Mm-hmm. Though that probably has your attention, but you're not even going to be able to pay attention to that noise inside of your brain until you deal with the 6,000 things that are really yanking that chain in a lot more obvious ways. So you have to start at wherever that is. So if you say, David, where would I go to patch up the system? I'm going to sit down and just sit down with you and say, Merlin, what has your attention right now on your desk, in your brain? Let's start there.
Right.
Okay, because if we don't deal with that one, that's going to prevent you from even doing the process. So I'm just going to walk right into wherever your attention is. That was what I learned, you know, from my management consulting, which was sort of the groundswell of where I began to work with this material, was walking in and saying, well, where do you start? you know, there's so many conversations that a team or a CEO or a group could start with. The best place to start is, hey, folks, what has your attention as a team right now? So beginning to be aware that, wait a minute, we just need to start to capture this in a very mundane way. It could be a very sophisticated thing, but it's a mundane thing you need to do about it. Call, write it down. Look at it. What does that mean?
Right. Yeah, as I've grown fond of saying, most people the time that most people realize they're out of toilet paper is not while they're standing in an aisle at the Safeway. As you like to say, this keys into the whole idea of ubiquitous capture. And so I like the concept and the way you've put that, that you're not just, it's not the time that you're just sitting at your desk with a piece of paper that you need to be capturing this stuff. Because that's not necessarily the time that it's going to be shaking loose in your head. And so that it seems like that could be, a lot of this comes back to, when I think about how to plug these holes, it comes back to starting at the very beginning, which is collection. So do you feel like sometimes one quick tip might be to sit down and do like a mental sweep?
Absolutely. The first thing to do is grab anything, because if it's on your mind, it's probably not in your system. So you need to start to be able to trust the system. I mean, ultimately, what you're going to need to be able to do is review and bring back. You need to be able to look at all the stuff from an objective, rational, or even subjective way, but at least in a coherent way, as opposed to, well, now I'm only thinking of a part of it, but there's a part that's missing. So how do you get to see the whole picture? And I think what GTD has done is define how you can most simply see the whole picture, both horizontally and vertically, of all the things that may have your attention. But in order to be able to trust that that menu is complete, you have to make sure that you've captured all the stuff that needs to be in there.
Right.
So, you know, and it's not an immediate process. The whole complexity of knowledge work means it's not necessarily that self-evident what these things are. They get pretty subtle. You know, I had a guy bring me in who was, I thought, was squeaky clean, one of the most productive people I've ever met on the planet. You know, less than a screen full of emails, had thrown away a BlackBerry for all the irrelevant stuff that had been creeping across it anyway. He was senior enough to just station people to detour that. The guy was an inveterate note taker, had a journal that he updated every night. I thought this guy looked squeaky clean. He still had 4 hours of stuff with me sitting down with him, asking about more subtle things that were on his mind, because they weren't the kind of latest and loudest that most people will capture once they've even gotten the capture habit, but there was just subtler stuff that he wasn't used to getting that stuff out of his head. So this gets pretty tricky in terms of being able to trust that you have the whole game out in front of you, at least in terms of raw data. Once you've got it all out, and you have the habit of processing and organizing, I think probably the front end capture is the most critical piece.
And no matter how strong your will, you're never going to be able to convince your brain that you've captured it all until you truly have.
Yeah.
That kind of residue is, there's going to be little stalactites of that coming down every day.
And back to your original point, I have to bring this in, is that it all really works together, because there's a part of you that will subliminally resist writing things down if you know you're not going to do anything with where you wrote it down, or you're going to lose it, or that you know, even if you threw it in your in basket, but you know you're not going to clean up your in basket, if ever, you know, or within the next 7 days, it'll crawl back up in your head. So some part of you, they all work together. If you knew that you would then deal with the things once you wrote them down, it'll give you more freedom to be able to write it down. So all these work together.
Episode 3, The Someday Maybe List.
Kind of a related thing. I'm curious about the role, how you see the role of, in particular, the Someday Maybe List working in the context of all of this. Because this has come up a few times, and it's something that's come up for me in implementing getting things done. And that is that it seems like, at a high level, people are using this list in three fairly distinct ways. Only a couple of which are even vaguely canonical. But one is that, to be honest, a lot of people use it as a junk pile. It's a place where a lot of people seem to be putting things that they don't want to think about right now. It becomes granny's attic, the stuff that they don't want to deal with. In the book, you seem to be talking about it more as a way to kind of park what you might think of as dreams and future plans. You know, I want to ride a bicycle up the Eiffel Tower or whatever. The kinds of things you want to do someday, but you don't have a commitment to now. And there's a third group that's otherwise theoretically very productive that seems to use it as ad hoc project planning, where they park tasks that they can't do yet. And I just want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about how you think the Someday Maybe List can be optimally used, since it does seem to be a source of holes, given that it can become such an unconscious, you know, 5-gallon bucket full of stuff you don't want to deal with. And I'm curious about how you use that best.
Well, you use the key word, unconscious. If you're totally out of control and you have to call the organizational paramedic, we run in. We're going to run in with a big box called crap. And every single thing you don't want to think about, you are avoiding, we're just going to gather all that stuff and throw it in one box. Do you know, in an hour, you'll have a clear head? Because if you don't know where something is, you'll know where it is. as long as that's okay with you. In other words, you could have a box that says, here's all the crap I just don't want to think about and I'm avoiding right now. And you put it all in there. As long as that's okay with you, you're clean. So the whole idea is, look, if this is just, if the someday maybe list is just this shunted place of just stuff I don't want to think about, as long as some part of you looks at it regularly enough and says, I'm still fine that I'm not thinking about that.
So just don't try to do it for all three is what you're saying. Don't try to make it a junk drawer and a place where you park ideas and a place with ad hoc.
Yeah, there's your problem. See, now you've blended your categories. Now they mean different things. Now your brain says, in order to make sense of this drawer, I'm going to have to rethink them all again.
Keeping your Fabergé eggs in the glove box.
That's why GTD is about very clean edges to what this stuff means to you. And it doesn't matter what it means to you. It matters that all of those things that mean that are there and not somewhere else. That's what'll screw you up.
One issue that comes up a lot, though, it seems, is this whole idea of, well, you know, first of all, a little backstory for people. In getting things done, the idea is to kind of collect your physical tasks into these kind of these projects, but you tend to not want to keep a whole lot of your project support materials mixed up with your tasks. The one way to keep things very tactical is to just collect your tasks in one place and your project support stuff in another. Now, how do you see that working for most people who are using the natural planning model? In your experience, how are most people using tasks versus project support materials? Are they using paper, and how are they keeping that stuff separated or together as needed?
How are they, or how should they?
Let's go with how should they.
How should they? Well, it's a good idea to make sure that when you're at a phone, you're not looking at a lot of calls you can't make. So what you want to do when you're down at the tactical doing and you're in a context to be doing, you don't want to have to rethink anything. You want to point and shoot. You know, it's kind of like running onto the field. It's too late to think. You need to have already thought. So what do you need to do once you've finished your thinking on a project? The end result of that will be actions you can take when you're in certain contexts. So there shouldn't be any thinking still required. You finish the thinking. The only time you now need to rethink is once you've finished that action. And if you haven't figured out what the next one is, then you need to go back and rethink now what's next, what would keep this going. So it's important that the project support material not get in the way of your real clean, here's what I need to do. And when I'm at a hardware store, here's what I need to do when I'm at my boss about that. That's why, you know, it would certainly be nice, as you know, if you could relationally database all this stuff so that when you park something out there, you could see it by who it's about, by what it's about, by where it happens, by how long it takes, by how much energy you have. It's like, well, God bless you. You know, that's great. But the truth is you're going to have to pick until the technology gets, you know, 10 times better than it even is right now to be able to coordinate all that very easily, which means if you got to pick, do I see what I need to do by where it happens or by what it's about? And that's pretty simple. If you kept the action still sorted by the projects, every time you got to a phone, you'd have to look through 43 project folders to find all the phone calls. You're not going to do that.
I think a lot of times when people are having trouble deciding where to park this stuff, getting back to our idea of the leaks in the system, to me, this leak seems to be happening at the level of processing. Because you've obviously gotten good at collecting this stuff. You know that there's a task that needs to be done at some point in the future. You know that you want to skydive off of a cliff, and you know that there's stuff you just want to keep in some kind of a junk folder. So the problem, to my mind, seems to be, so you've been good at collecting, but when you're at the point of processing, you really haven't decided where that needs to live.
I know, I'm in this too. Come on, you and I were in a meeting yesterday. You saw me mind map that stuff. Mm-hmm. My biggest danger is that mind map is now sitting in my computer or somewhere, and it hasn't gotten yet into my in basket for me to then be hard-nosed about picking that up and say, oh, okay, Marlin said he was going to do this now. I said, what does that mean now to me?
Right.
So you're right. That's the processing leak, and that's still the biggest challenge, probably one of the biggest I've got. I mean, I've probably got 100 working mind maps right now in Mind Manager on the computer. And boy, that's a rat's nest of stuff in there. And I have to regularly, oftentimes in my weekly review, I usually don't do it every week, but every 2 or 3 weeks I can feel like, oh God, I need to go through and clean up all those mind maps and make sure that nothing unprocessed is lying fallow in there.
Yeah.
So it's not perfect. You know, you're going to have to, you've,
and there's no way to automate that. There's no way that you're going to be able, there's no filter you can run or no way that you can automate that. That's going to just given the idea that's going to reflect the kind of commitments that you've made to some kind of an outcome.
Well,
so you're going to have to mine all that stuff piece by piece.
You know, that's why I keep coming back to the project list is king, because the project list, if at least I've captured the end stake in the ground out there of whatever all this stuff means. In other words, that you and I were meeting about, et cetera. At least as long as I've captured something there and I sit down to do a weekly review, that's going to trigger, wait a minute, I put this stake in the ground out there. What the heck? And let me go then find my 43 different notes about this from wherever they are. So the key is not going to be to have your support material remind you. There's too much of it. It's spread in too many places. The key is, when did you grab that outcome for which you generated all those 43 different things out there going on? 43. Somehow that's 43, popping crazy into my number. Head.
What can it mean? But it also, I also think this kind of keys to the idea of not having hard enough edges between the modes in which you're doing this stuff. Because I feel like some of the real ninja stuff in getting things done comes around at the point when you understand that a lot of people think this is an insulting thing to say. But when I'm ready to do my work, I don't want to have to think about my work. This goes back to your whole like turning the widget kind of idea. And it seems to me that if you've gotten in the habit of being really good about collection, now whatever your collection bucket is, for a lot of people, for me, a lot of that happens with index cards. For some people, that's going to be a palm or it's going to be what have you. The trouble is, though, you can't leave out that processing piece. And so, to give yourself the permission to completely dump all the stuff on your mind does not then absolve you from the need to turn that into something that's either actionable garbage or whatever. And that seems to be, if you don't honor those walls in your work and in doing each of these processes, you're bound to be hung up.
Sure. It'll crawl back up into your head. I mean, I know compulsive list makers that still walk around with anxiety and a head full of crap. Why? Because they don't do anything with the list. Right. They made the list and they stuck it somewhere. Well, that helps temporarily.
Yeah.
But it'll all crawl right back up if you don't trust that thing is getting somewhere, that it's going to get to zero sooner than later, and you've got it captured with clean edges.
And it's a little bit like seeing one of those guys who goes to the gym and does nothing but work on his arms and chest all day, and he's got those little toothpick legs. And it's in order for the GTD to work, you've kind of got to work the whole body.
That's the whole thing, and I hate to say it, but and just for the people who are going, oh my God, I'd have to do so much to make it work, I quit. No, don't quit. Right. Any little piece of this helps. Even if you just got, 10% more out of your head than you're used to keeping out of your head, if you knew it was out of your head, life is going to be better. So even if you just only process a few of your things that you might not normally process in the front end, life will be better. So I don't want to stop people from the process. I mean, it is challenging, because the truth is, the sort of holistic idea of all the different components working together, the whole is so much greater than the sum of the parts. I mean, you could have 95% out of your head, but you don't know that it's 95% because you don't know what's lurking in the 5%. So I tell people, look, in case I never see any of you ever again in my life, just hear this. 100% is so much different than 95. And you're not even talking about apples and oranges. You're talking different planets in terms of the reality of trusting that everything is out there and will be looked at appropriately versus, well, that's a lot, but there's more. Because it almost feels worse the bigger it gets if you don't know you got it all. Because you just don't know where the end of the tunnel is.
Episode 4, GTD for Teams.
Well, one sort of related thing, as long as we're on this, I don't know if this goes directly to what we're talking about, but the something that comes up a lot on the site, people come, they read the book, they've been to your seminars, and they walk away completely reinvigorated with the way that the GTD is already changing the way that they think about their work. And they want to see these kinds of changes and this kind of effectiveness work across, ideally across their whole organization. But most especially, I'm seeing people saying, what about my team? What about my 3 to 5 people who have to work together all the time? I mean, how do you get to 100% of emptying your brain out when you're talking about 5 people? And how do you deal with next actions? And how do you deal with, and what kind of cohesive system can you have within that team? How are you seeing that work well?
I was talking to a CEO of a startup just a couple of days ago, and we were talking about this very specific topic, and I was asking him sort of the same question. How does he make that work? Because he said, he doesn't like to go back and beat people over the head with how they do stuff. That doesn't work for him or for his team. And he said, quite frankly, David, all he really has to do is to make sure he works his process 100%. Because when he works his process 100%, guess what? Every single commitment anybody makes to him, he has captured. Every single thing he needs to talk to them about that is on their @Bill@Susan list the next time they walk in to deal with this guy. Now, being the top guy, that makes it a lot easier. Because if he starts tracking everything and everybody knows he's tracking everything, they know they damn well better start tracking everything. How do they do that? And then they show up hungry and he hands them my book, right? So, there's the simple answer. It's called, just hold people accountable to an outcome and then make sure that they have no excuses because they've seen the GTD model. And then they can do whatever they want. People often ask me, David, does your staff do this? Does your wife do this? I have no idea, nor do I care. Just right. Don't let anything fall through the cracks.
Let's take it just a little bit further, though. Do you see, for example, is my next action you're waiting on and vice versa? Do you see those puzzle pieces fitting together in a way that comports to a team approach to this
stuff? Absolutely. I mean, that makes so much difference. Again, you move up the, you know, I often frame it this way. It's like the nervous system of any entity or organism, the more sensitive and responsive that nervous system is, with no leaks in the system, no cracks, the higher up the food chain it is. Mm-hmm. So you'll see the highest on the food chain animals are the ones that have the most well-developed sensitive nervous systems that can respond to input and change faster than anybody else, mm-hmm. right? It's called, you know, lions and tigers, tigers and bears. Who could see them faster and respond to them easier than the ones that stick around, right? So in the same, in a way, there's no difference when you talk about an entity. And if I say, if you're a part of my team and there's something there, a change happened, and because we need to recalibrate toward whatever that new thing was, I have to trust that that input got to you. You're going to do something with that, and I'm not going to have to go follow you up and say, well, how come you didn't, you know, be aware of that? So just the very simple thing to be able to trust, I can write a handwritten note, drop it into your in-basket, trust that's going to get emptied within 24 hours. Not that you will do the work, but that you have now captured and defined that work. Man, we're moving on to very different problems. You don't get rid of
problems. So it comes in some ways, it comes a lot about trust and about
huge.
Trust within the system on a larger level of everybody there.
Absolutely.
There's a funny thing that happens. I saw this. I think you made some kind of a joke at the Roadmap seminar about this, and it's the same kind of topic I address sometimes. When I talk to people, and I at some point invariably mention how the most organized person in every office ends up being the admin, and wouldn't the admin love to see the skills that he or she has trickle up the food chain? And you suddenly see all these heads nodding along, and everybody, even the people who aren't the admin, agree. They understand that there's this, invariably, these people who are running around with a bucket behind the boss, trying to see those kinds of things. Well, there's no way they're ever going to feel like they're ever going to change that person. Do you see that happen? Do you ever see this stuff moving up the food chain? Somebody in the middle being able to radiate it out in both directions?
Absolutely. We see it all the time. As a matter of fact, that's oftentimes the way it happens, is the people who are really in the trenches that really make a change in behavior because they've got the biggest pain and they get the best relief. But everybody around them starts to see this whole different thing happening and went, oh my goodness, you know, this, maybe this sort of system is not just for the lowly schwugs of the universe. Maybe this is also applies to me too. You know, my biggest surprise, or one of my biggest surprise, Merlin, over the last 20 years is I thought as I moved further up the food chain in terms of sophistication and seniority in terms of people and organizations, the more they'd already have this nailed. I figured I was the last kid on the block. Wrong answer. I discovered that the higher I got, the more totally out of control these people felt, because then you move up into levels of ambiguity, incompletion, and weirdness. You know, if all you're doing is cranking a widget, pretty easy to stay organized. But if you're trying to implement diversity, it's like, later.
Right. And if you're at the, for lack of a better phrase, lower levels of the widget cranking, it becomes apparent pretty quickly if you aren't cranking the number of widgets you're supposed to.
Sure.
There's a phrase they use in software development, I think they call it going dark, where suddenly you stop hearing from a programmer and you stop seeing check-ins and things like that, and you want to go kind of knock on the door and make sure they're okay. And it seems to me that you could pretty easily encounter a CEO who's just sitting on the floor in the fetal position rocking, because there's nobody who's going to call them up and say, short of the board, there's no one who's going to say, so how are we doing on that?
That's,
you know,
right.
Where do we stand with that?
Oh, it's no kid. I don't think I've seen an exception. As sophisticated of people as I coach, and I'm some of the best in the world, every one of them has at least two or three of those, you know, skeletons in their closet.
Absolutely.
In terms of their psyche, about what they're avoiding deciding about right now. And, you know, so sitting and grappling with that is challenging. Now I have to be fair. Let's be fair at this. When you're talking about, okay, if you're talking about desk organized and details organized, sure, a lot of admin people, that's why they're hired, is to be able to sort of shore up those cracks in the system. But then you sit down and ask an admin, where do you want to be 3 years from now in your life? And they freeze. They go dark. You know, so, and whereas, you know, the CEO or the more their boss might go, hey, we're going to be here, here's where we're going, and they're hard charging. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my definition of successful executives are those who solve bigger problems than they create. So, but the truth is that some people may be highly focused at 30 and 40,000 feet and their desk is a mess. But that doesn't mean that they're not doing GTD. Yes, that part they may not be, but they may have another piece of it down that somebody who just looks like they're, quote, organized doesn't. Some people need to be more disorganized to really do GTD. You know, they're organized at a low level of, you know, they're not dealing with this big gnawing thing inside of them that says they haven't even shown up 10% on the planet in terms of who they are.
So if you're operating at a more strategic level, you need to break some eggs.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to anyway. I mean, come on, life's like that. And, mm-hmm. and what you don't want to do is be breaking that egg on the back end because you avoided making a decision about it. And that is one of the greatest sources of stress I've seen, is mid to senior level professionals avoiding making next action decisions on things that land on their plate until the heat forces them to, and then they spew the stuff through three levels in the organization. And then this translates down to, unfortunately, a lot of the admins that look really good are not that good at track at being an executive themselves, because guess why? They've been trained by a boss who's so out of control that they get stuff at the very last minute in the crisis mode, so they've wound up hiring and keeping people who are good at cleaning up crisis mess, but not really good at taking on projects and managing them proactively from the very beginning. And often when we're brought in to coach them, that's where their improvement opportunity is, learning how to keep an open loop and not finish it when their boss is standing in front of their face right there, but to throw it in their own in basket and put it in their mix and to deal with it that way. So it kind of works, it slices both ways.
Episode 5, email.
Well, David, it's no surprise to you that one of the biggest problems that people are having today is email. This has become such a primary way that we conduct so much of the communication in our life. And what I'm hearing from people nowadays is that email has basically become like a second job for a lot of them. And in a lot of companies, people are feeling like they just need to be checking their email all the time, or they're going to miss something. A lot of anxiety, a lot of shame. A lot of people terrified about what they haven't done with email. So I'd like to talk a little bit about healthy email and tips you've got for that kind of...
As you know, email is, there's no difference other than the speed and the medium, but otherwise it's just input like anything else. I mean, you can walk through nature and get a lot more input than that. And by the way, the problem is not information overload. You know, if so, you'd walk into a library and explode. You know, the problem is that an email, it's harder to distinguish between junk mail that can just go right into the drawer versus stuff that actually has meaning to you. Now, I know a lot of people that get just as hung up on junk mail that's lying around because they think of all the cool stuff in the catalogs that they might want to see. So it's the same issue there, too. So it's really just the speed. You know, people say, well, look, you need to get email to zero, you know, every night, just like you do your voicemail and answer machine. And people go, huh, what? And I say, well, look, you get your voicemail and answer machine empty, don't you? So what's the difference? There's no difference. And it doesn't mean finish what's in there. It does mean you need to step up to the plate and make executive decisions about what this stuff means. So all email did was magnify the fact that most people aren't trained to make executive decisions about inputs they let into their lives. And they just, it's so exacerbated the problem and sped it up and added huge volume to it that it became more obvious when people weren't avoiding it. But the avoidance of that is the same as the avoidance of stuff piled up on your desk or the stuff piled up in your head.
Right. The other problem a lot of people, I think, feel is that there's become like this differs from company to company, team to team, person to person, but the expectations associated with email have gotten very high. I mean, even as we all have our own idea about what email means and how we should treat it, in a lot of companies I'm talking to, I've got friends working down in the peninsula who basically have the expectation inside their company that they need to be answering relevant emails, whether it's from a list or from a person, in 5 or 10 minutes. So they feel like they can't even get away to do any work in the middle of the day because they have to constantly be monitoring and flipping that stuff around. So how do you deal with a job where the implicit understanding is that you are going to be monitoring your email all day long?
Make that okay. Or get a different job. I mean, come on, look, Merle, ultimately the GTD process, all it does is exacerbate and clarify what the problems and issues really are, which is there's always more to do than you can do. Now, all it did was give people more of a loaded gun to then, you know, have lack of clarity about what exactly the expectations are in terms of the nature of their job. But come on, you know, let me give you an example. I was doing a seminar a while ago with a bunch of OBGYN docs. Right, in a healthcare facility. Now, these OBGYN, right, they're wearing pagers and beepers and whatever because just babies decide to show up when they decide to show up. You know, so they're sitting there trying to work on this, the thinking about their own personal systems, you know, and then beepers are going off. And, the general context of frustration is, oh, my God, it's not even worth trying to get organized because these damn beepers are going off all the time. And I'm going, well, excuse me, look, if you're an OBGYN and your beeper goes off, from my point of view, one of two things should pop into your head. You know, either, wow, a new soul coming onto the planet, or cash, or both. And if you don't like that, you're in the wrong job. You made a bad career move. Excuse me. You know, if you're an OBGYN and can't take surprise right. or things showing up ad hoc. So that's kind of a hyperbolic but still a very real example of the same sort of thing. Now, the truth is that a lot of people's bosses are unconscious, as well as their boss is unconscious, as well as their boss is unconscious. So the whole, you know, as the volume and intensity of communication and feedback loops have sped up out there, which email has made so much more available, you know, things that can come across faster. You know, and it does represent a way you can get a jump on somebody else and get stuff done faster and easier and smoother. It became a highly seductive way to just start firing stuff across there. You know, and so, yes, a lot of that has sped up, but what's required, for instance, just the whole GTD process, for people to not acknowledge that it takes an hour a day to sit down and think and process and organize the new inputs coming in. And if you haven't even accepted that, and a lot of people listening to this probably haven't even accepted that, and they're letting themselves get booked wall-to-wall day, all-day meetings, and then sit and bitch that they have to then spend an hour and a half processing what happened that day. Excuse me, at some point you're going to get it.
Yeah, there's definitely a couple levels of problems here, at least. I mean, there's certain kinds of things. I like to think that there's ways to deal with a high volume of email by something I've written up in a series called Inbox Zero, which is really just taking a lot of GTD-esque practices and applying them to basically processing to zero. And I think for a lot of people, there's a hang up in the idea that they think the only way to deal with an email is to respond to it in kind. And I think one of the ninja moves here is to learn that it's really about processing. And it's about a very early end of deciding what you need to do about it. And then the thing that I've seen so much success with is liberating appointments, tasks, anything that's kind of nested and stuck in those emails, liberating all that stuff into an external system that's not email.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know, what is email? Email is we're creating a little bit of an ambiguous distinction that says, well, what's in email? Well, right. I use Lotus Notes, so notes, there's email, there's calendar, there's all of that data management and stuff in there. What I don't want, email is basically what most people say about email is just their in basket in email.
That's right.
And everybody be further ahead if they made email like they made answer machines, called it blow up if you got more than 42.
That's right. Well, the problem that I started to realize is that people are this gosh, this seems like such an obvious thing, but until you really see people using it, but people have really started to think about their email primarily in terms of its ability to deliver new information, which is really probably not the healthiest way to look at it. Instead, I mean, the way I've put it is, if you're a short order cook, you're in the business of making sandwiches. You're not in the business of stacking orders. And there's certain affordances to the way most email programs are set up that really encourage a lot of fiddling and a lot of sorting and a lot of scrolling. And I think, like I say, I think the key move is to stop doing that. And the first time you touch it, find some way to liberate that stuff out of there. Otherwise, like you say, all you're going to be thinking about is that whole BlackBerry habit, right? That whole idea of like, people aren't doing anything. They're just checking all the time. But then what are they doing with it?
Right. And that's why I think my prediction is that in about 3 years, people are going to have a bigger BlackBerry. They're going to have a watermelon. They're going to have a watermelon on their belt. Why? Because they ain't paying attention to the BlackBerry now. See, the reason most people have BlackBerries, they aren't paying attention to their email. Now they're not paying attention to their BlackBerries. Now we're going to have a watermelon. Because you're not paying attention to the other thing. And now you're going to have something else to avoid and fiddle with. So you're right. Now that's hyperbolic, I know.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you're right, that people really need to understand. Now, I do emergency scanning too. You do too. Come on, back and go, I look real quick, see if any landmine's going to blow up on me. Mm-hmm. But to do that more than once, where you're rethinking, and it's another version of stack, and you lay it back in there. So again, it's back to the executive decision making and training yourself to do that fast.
Well, I'm curious. One thing that I've been advocating for on the site is the idea of just checking email a lot less, and the fact that so many programs like Outlook or even Mail.app ship with a default auto check time that's actually pretty quick, and in such a way that if you really let that beeping and blinking become the way, it becomes this way, this constant way of stealing your attention away from whatever you're doing. So I started really advocating for checking your email maybe every hour or so. And I'm curious what you think about that, because I know you check your email probably less than that. But what I'm hearing from people is even that idea of suggesting checking once an hour, to them, that's the crazy. They can't imagine not checking it every minute or every 5 minutes.
Well, you can't imagine. It depends on your job. If you're expecting at any moment you might hear about a $20 million contract coming across, I'm going to leave it on.
Well, if you work in a Korean missile silo, you're going to need to know minute by minute what's
Absolutely.
Going on.
Absolutely. Sure. So a lot of it depends. So some days, I haven't checked my email for a day and a half now. Pretty rare. But the thing is, once you and your culture really start to get this, so much more is handled on the front end to begin with, you don't get get the fires and crisis. See, a lot of people are getting emails about a crisis that just blew up that they do need to handle right then because nobody had dealt with their email while it was sitting in there when it first showed up. And so the syndrome doesn't self-correct, it self-perpetuates.
Well, two things. First of all, I mean, I think one thing that we've addressed on the site and a lot of people are looking at is saying, well, you know, we've got these tools that have not really advanced very much in the last, whatever, 15 years. And so a lot of it is we're kind of trying to use a hammer as a can opener in some ways. We're trying to use these tools in the way that they're configured right now. And, you know, what I really need to know, I need to know when something important happens, whether that's people visiting my website or people that need work from me or something important that's happening at home. And so in some ways, I think a lot of what we need is better notifications or more fine-grained notifications. So you can say, you know what, don't beat me if it's just something from a mailing list that I read once a month. You know, some way of seeing that technology involved in such a way that it supports a different kind of trust in the system.
Sure.
The kind of trust that says, you know what, I can walk away from this for half a day and know if it's really important, it'll get to me.
I'd say fine, but there's a two-edged sword here. I say agents are fine if you can sort the filters by, okay, these more important ones, I want to hear those first, but as long as you still get it all zeroed out.
Yeah.
As long as then, in other words, the first ones I want to see are from person XYZ. That's fine. And I do that too. I'll sometimes sort by who they're from so that I can handle that in that way. But it still gets to zero. If you only sort that way and then still let those secondary things lie in there, then you're dead. But sorting, absolutely. I mean, being able to, you know, I've got different, in Lotus Notes, it lets you color different emails as they're coming in from different people. And, you know, it's still not perfect, but it helps. And I appreciate that.
Well, another thing that I've done, this is the funniest thing. I had a post about this a while back when I first got a Gmail account, there was something really refreshing about the way Gmail set up, just in the sense that you've got an inbox and you got an archive, and then you've got all your mail. And just by the use of all this sufficiently intelligent technology, you can tag these things and you can have them all appear together in groups. And something about that was a real Zen slap for me, and it completely changed the way that I was doing my own email. So I've gotten down to now, and I think Gina on Life Hacker has talked about this and some other folks have looked at this issue. I mean, more and more of us are really stripping way down. So from my days back in Eudora, when I was in Eudora back in the day, and I would have like 60 different folders for filing and subfolders and filing, make file, 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 don't do any of that stuff anymore. So now basically to me, it's all about action. Something comes in that inbox, I immediately decide, do I need to do anything about this? And if so, where do I park that? And the archives, it all just gets tossed into one big archive. If it's stuff I need to respond to, it goes into a respond, and I winnow that down through the day. But no more of this Byzantine folder system stuff.
Yeah, well, over-engineering, you know, can eat your lunch, you know, especially with that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, and back to GTD-ishness is, you know, you got to sort right on the front end, actionable or not.
First time it hits you.
First time it hits you, and then see it. And again, given emergency scanning, and that everybody has to do that too, but don't sit there and open it and then spend time on it and not then make those decisions in terms of where this goes. And once if there is no action, then it truly is either dump it or archive it. And, you know, and I'm a big pack rat. I have 2 years worth of email on this computer because I can.
Right.
You know, I'll keep all kinds of stuff. I love it. I love to be able to search back into all that. It's great.
Well, then to get even more, drill down further into the GTD-ishness, for my friends who are working down in the peninsula who have no choice but to be checking their email in order to feel like they're part of the team and so on.
Yeah.
You're saying that takes a recalibration at a higher level. It's not something as simple as just how you deal with email. You're saying they've got a bigger problem.
Well, or that bigger opportunity, that could be their job. I mean, what's your job? Until you can tell me what your job and your agreements are in the organization, there's no way to say what you're supposed to do with email.
And I think what you're pointing out here, though, is, I mean, this is whatever, you know, Sino's paradox. We're trying to put two things in the same space here. This is the basic, the most fundamental problem that we're seeing right now, which is a basic disconnect on this level. People have these jobs where they have a tremendous amount of work that they need to accomplish in every given day, week, or month. But that's the problem, is the email and the keeping up and the communications and the meetings and all of this other stuff. It's almost as though nobody's monitoring the way people's time is being spent and the way that on a day-to-day basis, the average knowledge worker is having to make some really difficult decisions about, you know, this game of musical chairs that they're destined to lose.
Welcome to life. You know, it's called, hey, I'm sorry, we're all alone in this together.
My
job is not to deal with overwhelm with my staff. My job is to hand, every single boss has 4 to 10 times as much to do as any one of their direct reports. I could prove that to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a few exceptions, but not many, because stuff constipates uphill, not down. And the truth is that everybody ought to be overwhelming their staff 10 times more than they are, because at some point the staff goes, I can't do it all. See, I thought you'd never bring it up.
But not to generate noise.
Not to, absolutely not to generate noise. I'm not.
I think a lot of this, what people are dealing with is just, you know, I think spam is a problem that at least for me and my friends is getting a little bit better. I think the technology is getting better to deal with straight up, you know, spam, completely useless noise. But, you know, this comes back to one issue that I can never get away from, which is that we all have a really different idea of what an email is for and what you do with it and how you treat it. And this goes straight back to when I came on, I got a Pine account in 1995, a shell account, seeing how some people, you know, on AOL would treat things a certain way. And some people would treat every email like a little hug that need to be, you know, reciprocated. And some people think treat email like a blog, right? Where they send funny stories to 95 people. And,
even the very simple ones is you get one. Are you supposed to say back, thanks, I got it, or do I trust it went into a black hole?
Right.
So that's why in our company we built in one of our standards is that we trust that stuff, that if I don't hear, everything is fine. Now, it's tricky business, so there's no simple answer to that. You have to have a culture with that, and you know, come on. Ultimately, I got onto EasyLink in 1983 with a Radio Shack Model 100 so that it could free me up to be a virtual person.
Where there was a technical constraint of having short mails.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And not only that, what is this? I can only see three lines at a time.
In the days before 256K kitty photos could be attached to emails.
Yeah, absolutely.
I yearn for those days.
But I think culture is mature, and at some point this starts to sift out.
So, let me ask you the question behind the question then, because I guess what I feel like I'm seeing is a conversation that's not happening at a higher level, regardless of how busy you think the people who work for you should be. I guess I feel like this is something that's still, there are people having to struggle with this in relative obscurity. There's not a support system in place for somebody being able to escalate this and say, you know what, as a team, XYZ company, you know, here in Silicon Valley is generating a huge amount of noisy email every day. Where does that, in your opinion, where does that conversation start to happen? And who's responsible for looking down and saying, hey, what am I getting in return for this guy spending 6 hours a day on email?
Well, there are two issues. One issue is the person efficient enough? A lot of people are yelling and screaming and crying wolf out there because they are not cleaning up email, they're not handling it efficiently, and they could get a whole lot more done with a whole lot less effort. And they're sitting staring at 3,000 emails saying, I'm buried, and call, well, who let that happen? Mm-hmm. You know, so come on, where is that coming from? Sure, I get junk mail too, but I just make, I like junk mail. It's like, wow, that's some of the coolest things I've seen. I mean, people say, oh, well, I should get off lists. Say, which list you want to get off of? Well, not that one, because I want to get, oh, not that one either. So people pay a lot of
lip services. So they haven't committed.
They have. Not only that, I mean, come on, if you get really good, first of all, you need to be as good and fast and as efficient as you can be. Now, if that's happening and you're still letting mission-critical stuff fall through the cracks, then mission-critical stuff is falling through the cracks. Now you have an organizational development issue that says you're either understaffed or somebody hasn't understood what your job is or somebody doesn't get what's going on, and that may need to bump upstairs.
Episode 6, Interruptions. Well, David, as you may know, a lot of the people who visit 43 Folders feel set upon by the number of inputs in their life, the number of interruptions and distractions that they have to deal with, the things that they're constantly having to juggle, the plates that they're forever having to spin. So I want to talk a little bit about some strategies for dealing with that stuff, making smarter decisions. And I mean, one of the things is it's obvious that there are the interruptions that people give us, and then there are the distractions that we give ourselves. What do you think about that? And how are you helping people to deal with the number of inputs that they have?
You know, well, let's go down to a real tactical thing. You can bump this up to a lot of levels to talk about that. Should you be getting the input? You know, how are you avoiding deciding what the input means? There's a lot of things that can make inputs seem like a problem. Interestingly, you know, somebody did a study of executives' sort of work habits, and the surprise to them was that a lot of very senior executives don't consider interruptions. As a matter of fact, they consider that the way to manipulate their work.
That's the work that they're doing.
That's the work that they do. It's called, wow, this person just showed up. Let me see what input they have to me. How can I utilize this to get my goals in terms of where I'm going? As a matter of fact, they'd feel like the world was stagnant if they were not getting those kind of surprises and new things. Of course, what those people have done is make sure that they've got a lifestyle where they have no residue, and they come in early and they get the deck clear. And when that person leaves, they process and organize that and distribute that into the system so that then the next interruption, they're not distracted by the last one. So there is the GTD process of how quickly, how cleanly, how black belt can you be of new input coming in, so that it's not creating residue, it's just creating new input that then just goes into your mix and matures your thinking. Right.
And it brings us back to this idea of like walls and fences. So between these different projects, like your ability to sort of change gears becomes kind of an important executive skill.
You know, Merlin, come on, here's the most concrete example of that. And I just did a short little video for our Connect program on this, but it's very simple, like a little three-sided thing called an intray. All you have to do is to make sure that when stuff is coming at you, what you're doing is take the whatever work you're doing. If you decide to answer the phone and stop doing whatever you're doing, you know, many times I do, because what's on the phone call? Great. I just take what I'm doing, throw it back in my in basket, pick up the phone, pick up a pen. I'm taking input, whatever that input's coming in, right? I'm getting off the phone. Somebody walks in, interrupts me again. So fine. I just take that note, tear it off, throw that in the in basket as they're walking in. So even knowing how to deal with an in basket and very low tech, how do I grab stuff on a piece of paper? Where do I throw that paper? Now I've got a placeholder. But the problem is most people don't trust placeholders. Their psyche is trying to be placeholding. So after three interruptions, they're out of control. They came in early, they got organized, and then in 2 minutes, they're out of control because they don't know how to deal with bookmarks on those inputs that they trust will then get processed later on. And so they have the freedom to be able to just placehold it. See, that's why, by the way, a lot of people don't like interruptions, is because they don't trust their own system. So you get interrupted with input, and you know it's something you still need to be doing, but it's not what you should be doing right then.
You're secretly thinking, I'm never going to make it back to this.
That's right. So you have to go deal with it right then. Another example of that is bosses who actually interrupt staff because they don't have a system to communicate to staff and don't figure they're tracking. So it's in their head.
They don't trust
that
they can drop
it on them right then, because they'd lose it if it didn't get there. So the lack of a good systematic approach to communication and commitments is automatically going to make interruptions feel like a pain instead of just your process.
There's a terrific system that I wrote up a while back. I think the guy's name is Martin Turnauth, I want to say. I read this on one of Tufte's boards. He's come up with this amazing paper-based system that I found very inspiring. The only reason I mention it is it's very heavily based on the idea that you can only be working on one thing at a time. His entire paper-based system is based on those cool folders I was showing you, the kind of two-sided little plastic folders. You get those and you label them. And the whole idea is when you're working on something, you're working on that thing. There's nothing else on your desk except that one thing out. And if you get interrupted or you need to work on something else, you shovel it all together, it goes back in that folder, and you put that folder into your pending area. Now, this sounds like the easiest thing in the world, but if everybody who's listening to this right now looks at their desk, they're going to see that they're actually kind of half-assing through five things right now, more likely than not. But there's something really, that's a pretty sophisticated move to be able to keep that stuff. And I've seen how you work. I've seen that you work like this. You do. You shovel it into a folder, you move it aside, and you say, okay, what's next? You know, is that a practice that you see being something that people should be adapting?
Oh, absolutely.
At the desk and electronically?
Well, if you can't do it in paper, you're not going to do it electronically. So it's funny. The interesting thing about this, if you don't know how to process something in one medium, you won't be able to process in the other either. So people often show up, should I go paper, should I go digital? I say, if you can't do both, you're in trouble. You need the option. If you can only do one, you're in jail. You know, you need to be able to know, I could do it here, I could do it there, because you know what the doing is. You know what the underlying principles about the input is. It's not the medium. It's what do I need to do with that? So you're right. Knowing how to work it in paper is absolutely critical. Because you're never going to go paperless.
That's right.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
There's too much out there that you have to deal with that way.
Well, you know, a lot of the folks who come to 43 Folders in particular are, you know, we say this in a good way, they're geeks. They're people who spend a lot of time on the computer, having jobs, people who do things like system administration, programmers, developers, designers. One thing is a lot of people who do jobs like that really benefit from having large blocks of time to be able to set aside to work on something. So most programmers will tell you, I mean, it's kind of become a best practice to give a programmer his or her own office, because you see such a leap in productivity when they can say, you know what, this is going to be an hour that I set aside to work on that. What kind of tips do you have for people for either changing gears more quickly or for finding ways to really focus your attention and firewall time for certain bits of projects? How do you recommend working with
them? You know, I would recommend, especially if you're in an environment where people grab your time. Now, I'm not, so I don't need to do this. But if you're in one of those environments where somebody could grab your calendar, get on your calendar, and is always asking for you, and you have some sort of next action that takes longer than an hour of uninterrupted time to really do it well, you better block it in. So creating some brackets for yourself. Now, you better be careful, because if you make that commitment and you break it, you've now done yourself a disservice. So you have to be very careful. It's like training kids and dogs. Give yourself as few rules as possible, but don't break them. So what you don't want to do is be scheduling yourself to do a lot of things that the world is going to cause you to unhook from, because then you won't trust your own process.
I got an interesting email from somebody just the other day about this problem. There's someone who's in the lamentable position of having a desk that's right in the middle of everywhere and everything, and people are constantly coming and interrupting them while they're on the phone, coming up to them and asking, like basically standing over them with a piece of paper. And my advice to them was to say, you know what, this is something that's important that we get right. So why don't we right now schedule 10 minutes to talk about this later today? I need to finish this call. And make that a practice.
Absolutely.
I mean, because part of it, do you think there's a certain element? Doormat's probably too strong a word for it, but it seems like it's something where people, like dogs and children, people learn patterns. And if you keep allowing people the idea that you're interruptible and you'll just bounce back,
sure,
it creates a certain expectation.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you've been in our office. I mean, our sort of the office we're in right now. I mean, we're kind of growing fast. Everybody's kind of still on top of each other. But if you sit down, you'll see you walk into that office and people are not interrupting each other.
Yeah.
You know, once you get this into the culture, and when you do, you pay attention, because it's worth it. Because there's only two reasons I'll let myself be interrupted: warm human contact and emergencies. Mm-hmm. You try to minimize the emergencies. But if you just want to be if you want to schmooze, sometimes I'll stop everything, because that's more important than anything else. So you have to be careful about that and not be,
because you're David Allen, you can do it and know that you're not worried about what you're not doing.
Yeah.
You're good at that. I remember when I was working at .com back in the day, and it was all about the interruptions. I remember hearing about something they were doing in Japan. I don't know if this is true, but supposedly they introduced this thing called the red sash. Did you ever hear about this?
No.
And if you were, of course, it's this Japanese office and you're packed on top of each other. And if you had put on the red sash and were walking around, nobody was allowed to talk to you.
Right.
Because it was a way of saying, and I've always thought that would be so great. I wish there was some hat that I could wear, the leave me alone hat, that would just let people know.
Well, you know, Target's a big client of ours right now. And I always make the joke, especially about the weekly review. I said, look, if you have your own office where you can close the door, it becomes a little bit easier. But if you work in prairie dog country, heads popping up and around, it's a little more challenging. Yeah. So I said, so what you need to do is go get yourself some yellow police tape and just put it across a cubicle when you're doing your weekly review. And I've done that as a joke. Guess what? Target now gives yellow police tape to everybody who goes through our seminars. And they all have permission in the culture, when they're doing their weekly review anyway, to strap a piece of yellow tape across their cubicle. And everybody leaves them alone. A fabulous little iconic
way. I think that's a business opportunity right there.
Great.
You're leaving money on the table.
Really.
Episode 7, Implementing GTD.
David, I think arguably 43 folders wouldn't even exist if people didn't have a problem with implementation of GTD. As solid of a system as it is, there seems to be somewhere along the way, I would track it to about usually the second, third, fourth week of GTD, where suddenly people start getting the cold sweats again. And the initial feeling of being completely tuned into how it's going starts to fall apart, and they're losing trust in their system. Are they doing their reviews right? So let's just straight out, implementation. What are the things, where are the hangups, and how can people deal with this? What are you seeing happen with
people? It's a really good question, and we're still working with what are the best things we can do to help support people. You know, people say, gee, David, how long did it take you to get it? And I say, well, 60.5 years.
Ask me again in 6 months.
Yeah, that's right. You know, for instance, I learned about reviewing projects, so that your day is clear, managing a service station a block off a freeway in L.A., that we were also renting U-Haul trailers and restoring cars, as well as pumping gas and literally putting out fires and crises driving off the freeway. Now, I learned that, I better keep a folder of every single project I had around that station in front of me, come in early and close the door to that office and not let myself go out on those islands until I had spent 30 minutes absolutely shuffling papers to see all the stuff I could and should be doing. Then it was like Nightmare Alley for 12 hours, but I was clear. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody, to learn that you need to do a regular review of all your projects. So that's what people are buying when they're buying the David Allen Company and GTD, and this educational process is saving an awful lot of time about how do you get to that behavior. Now, That said, it's called, well, okay, it took me that long to figure out how powerful that is. So, yeah, can overnight people say, yeah, okay, let me sit down and list every single project I have and make sure at least every 7 days I look at all of those to make sure I'm clear and clean? Simple idea. But getting the habit of thinking at that level and grappling with all you need to clarify ambiguous things into projects, turning problems into projects and trusting that that's there, that takes quite a bit of change in behavior to be able to get that done. So you got to stick with it.
Is it important in the case of the gas station filing plan, is it important that you had firewalled that time when you were away
Absolutely.
From the craziness?
As a matter of fact, the guy who owned the station, who actually sort of trained me with a little bit of that, he said, David, I'm going to fire you if I see you leaving that office for the first 30 minutes. No, he did, because it's so easy to get sucked into the world out there as opposed to work on your process.
That's so funny. There's several different, over the period of time I've been doing this, several different times during the week in which I've tried to do my weekly review. And the two that have worked best, I think you recommend, is a Friday afternoons is one you recommend. I've had good luck with Friday afternoons because things are kind of winding down. People are leaving the office. I'm not getting bugged. But then, you know, really, for some reason, Sunday afternoons work really well for me. It's a time when I have a lot of my own discretionary time to spend on something. And for some reason, it just works great to have this kind of firewall time away from the fray.
Yeah. Well, you know, all of these things are just the habits that people have to change. So simple idea to keep everything out of your head. But unless you've been raised to keep everything out of your head, which, by the way, we now have kids that are being raised by GTDers that are being trained that, hey, in baskets, out of your head. And they just go, hey, this is the way to do it. Gee, Grandma, I understand you used to keep things in your head. How was that? You know, so we're moving into a world where these habits are not going to be so tough to change because we will have been raised with them.
That's great, Grandma. But what's the next action here? I love you and everything, but chop chop. Enough with the talky, more with the worky.
So back to implementation.
People, yeah, where are the hangups? What are you saying?
The problem is like people have life onto cruise control. Whatever your system is and whatever your habits are, there's a kind of a cruise controlness to that. And you do have a system or you wouldn't be getting work done. You don't want to have to always be thinking about your system. You need to be doing your work. I understand that. So what happens is people get all enthralled and glassy-eyed about GTD and they go back, and as long as they can keep hold of the steering wheel changing in the new direction, they're fine. The problem is, you know, hey, I want to go fish. There's no fish over here. I'm going to go change my direction. So then you grab hold of the rudder and you move the boat over to where you think the fish are. That's right. Great. But then you got to go fish. Got to let go of the rudder. What happens? Mm-hmm. Cruise control takes back over. So it's that 2 week period you mentioned or 3 week period. That's about how long, if you're really, really disciplined, you can stay focused on the new process. But until you have regrooved the neural patterns so that the cruise control is zero in and weekly reviews, and that takes a while. I mean, the best of the best of the best. I my staff and all kinds of people yell at me for ever saying this because they say, David, it takes 2 years, Merlin, to get this. I'm talking to really, really good people. When I say get it, it doesn't mean throw up your hands and go, oh, God, I don't have 2 years to spend in doing this. It's getting better all along. And I've got a whole lot of people that would say, David, I never believed it when you said that.
That's
right. Then 2 years later, they loop back around and go, God, I feel like I'm really just getting it now. So a lot of that is to lighten up. You know, come on, it is a fairly big habit change.
But it's a long game.
Just figure it. Look, come on, life's going to be another. You're going to be another day older tomorrow, whether you get your in basket a little closer to empty or not. So just keep going. So you got to put one foot in front of the other. But the key is to keep around this material and keep around people doing it. It's like anything else. You know, if you get around people exercising, it's a lot easier to exercise. Quite frankly, you should not be thinking about GTD. You need to be thinking about your projects and your actions and make sure that everything is off your mind. You have attention on. That's what GTD is about. So I understand what you mean by I need to think about how do I get the process to make that happen. But you don't want to get then wrapped around the axle about GTD. You need to be using the GTD process, and it doesn't take that long to do it. How long does it take to say, wait a minute, I'm thinking about my mom. What's about that? Write it down.
Right.
Put in your in basket. What's the project? Oh, that's right. Mom's birthday is coming up. We're thinking of making that a big deal. Fabulous. I got a project now called Look Into Mom's Birthday as a Big Deal. Boom, goes on your project list. So it doesn't take it. You know, what I just said, you can do it that fast as I just said it. So it's training yourself to then think that way and to do those things and to get to those kind of end results. Call, how long will it take me to get a list of my 65 projects I really have right now and figure out all the next actions about them? That should be the focus. Now, you can get that focus right away, but training yourself to constantly keep coming back around and saying, oh, yeah, I haven't done that yet. What do I now need to do to get more stuff off my mind? So it's not so much thinking about the process as it is utilizing the process. The process is not hard.
And so last thing, for people who do feel like they've kind of fallen off the wagon, or they're having some kind of a problem with the leaks and the trust in their system, do you find in general that, a lot of people tell me this is a system they feel they can get back into. That's one reason they like this.
Yeah.
So if somebody's having that trouble today, what's the quickest way for them to feel like they're getting back into it?
You know, the nice thing about GTD, it's very easy to fall off and very easy to get back on. That's you know, it's as easy to get back on as it was to fall off.
Start with the, like we've talked about this a little bit in another segment, start with the mental suite.
Sit down, write it down, get it out of your head again, get your in basket clean, start to organize your desk, start to grab hold of the things you can grab around, get yourself some clean edges again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go pick up all the stuff you've let lie on the floor and lie on the edge of the desk and throw it back in your in basket. Start the process again.
And if all else fails, you could always go do something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we coach people, and that's why our coaching over many years sifted down to 2 days we need with people, because it takes anywhere from 1 to 6 hours usually to gather all the incompletes to begin with, throw the stuff into the end basket. Then it takes, you know, up to, you know, 8 to 12 hours to have everybody then go through and actually make the decisions and customize their system with the input. And that takes 2 days. People often say, God, does it take 2 days to get this? I say, it takes 2 days to start to groove your nervous system and to give you a taste of actually what it's like, you know, to be sort of at the holy grail call at zero and see it all in one place. We want you to get that reference point. So there is an investment that has to be made. I'm not going to kid anybody. You have to invest in it, but it doesn't take long to start the process, and especially if you've got the good tools around you, something else we should probably talk about, called what are the key simple things I can do to make sure that I'm not sitting there hung up on my system. I'm actually using it, and then get yourself back into it again. It doesn't take a lot, but yep, mind sweep, make some decisions, start to get your list current again.
Episode 8. GTD 2.0.
Well, David, one of the things that comes up a lot on the site, people, you know, who have gotten very into getting things done, who have read the book backwards and forwards numerous times, something people say a lot of the time, you know, it took you however many, 20, 60, 80 years, however long it took you to write. I think you do real well for your age. Well, it took you years to cobble all that information together and to come up with those systems. And then there was a snapshot at some point in 2001 that became the Getting Things Done book. And now it's 5 or 6 years later. And the question a lot of people are asking is, you know, what have you learned since then, since the book came out? What have you observed? What are you doing differently? What would you amplify or play down? This is a question straight off the boards on our sites. What do you think you'd do differently, or what would you amplify?
You know, it's a good question, because, of course, the publishers are banging on my door called book three, book three. We want book three. Come on, David, where's book three? To take advantage of the window here. And I, you know, I'm grappling with it in terms of what would that look like. The truth is that in terms of the basic information inside of there, absolutely no difference whatsoever.
Really?
No, none whatsoever. I mean, the book is, interestingly enough, we went through 2 line edits on that thing to strip out every single time-based buzzword that we could, so that we knew this was potentially going to be evergreen. So that 25 years from now, you pick up that book, that'll be as alive and well and applicable to whatever world you're in at that point. And that was somewhat in the back of our mind when that was written. I mean, it took 4 years to get that out. As simple as that may look, that was not an easy event to try to figure out how to frame that appropriately and to make sure that it was universal and generic enough and yet specific enough that it could truly serve as a manual to anybody at any level. And I don't think that's not been nothing but validated in terms of that's what that is. So there doesn't need to be another version of the basic information and the basic methodologies. Those are the same. Let me tell you where my mind has gone in terms of what might be next. One big frontier that I think I didn't address appropriately in the book was how to give yourself permission to take whatever time it takes to get into this. So a big new frontier for me has been finding out that just because I stand up there and it's pretty simple and pretty obvious, how come everybody doesn't get it right away? You know, how come there is, to a large degree, a fairly low implementation percentage? People think they get, you know, they go out and they get a labeler and their life is transformed and they're, you know, and they're glassy eyed and they're gushing and people go, what happened to you? And, or they're suddenly responding to emails more on a consistent basis. And these are you know, I don't want to downplay these. These are actually can be extremely significant events. And if those are built in, you can say, wow, this was really incredible. But read the book again, and you'll see a whole lot of stuff that you didn't see that was in there. So how come you didn't get all the other stuff that was in there the first time? And that, you know, I've just come to realize, you know, it's not an overnight process to get this. And that the best thing I could do is figure out, okay, how can I help people shorten the time span of getting you to black belt? You know, and why don't people get to black belt as fast as they could or should? What are the road bumps? What are the things that get in the way? What causes people to fall off? And how do we assist people to be able to get back on, assuming it's somewhere that you want to be? But, you know, quite frankly, in the 5-6 years that the book has been out, I can't remember one email or piece of feedback I've gotten, and there's 500,000 of those out there in print right now in 22 languages. Nobody has written back and said anything was wrong in there.
Really?
So, no, nothing.
So you're thinking mostly, you feel like the system itself is sound and complete, and so one angle is what we might call like a quick start. Some way to make it real easy for people to kind of grok the whole process very quickly.
Yeah,
stem to stern, not just the implementation of a to-do list system, but how that fits into this larger GTD picture.
Well, not only that, a lot of the fun here is this onion gets peeled. You know, you get GTD, and then you go, oh, wait a minute, I didn't get GTD, but now I really got GTD. Well, you'll find out there's another level of, oh, wait a minute, I didn't quite see that thing yet. Let me see that again. It's kind of like the really simple things that if they actually tap to a real core principle, there will be an endless amount of sophistication and maturity of the application of that core principle that will map to your sophistication and maturity, which is changing. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I've learned is that I can still say the same 12 things, and you come back around 6 months later and I tell you those same 12 things, you will hear different things than you heard 6 months ago. Not because I'm saying them differently, but because you got different ears to hear. So learning that people have different ears to hear over a transition time, and therefore, how do I best support that process? One of the reasons we created GTD Connect, that didn't come out of the blue. It really came out of this huge, you know, sort of pent-up demand that was coming at us of people that are saying, look, I know I need to be around this. I need to stay connected to this. That's why we call it Connect. If you just connect into it, it's kind of like, well, if I join the gym and get the costume and have some friends that go, it'll be a lot easier to exercise regularly. Well, the same is true with anything. So it'll be a lot easier, we've already discovered that, if people get around. I mean, you get around me or our staff very long, you'd feel really silly if you weren't doing these behaviors. Not that we make it that, gee, are you emptying your head? Are you keeping track? It's just, it becomes the expected behavior. And it's like, oh, okay. And so it's a whole lot easier to do that. It's kind of like learning a language. You go to the country and it's a lot easier to get it because everybody's speaking the language. Well, the same is true with GTD. So we're just trying to create a virtual community through GTD Connect. And so that's part of where I'm going, and that would be next in terms of just how do we help implement support and build on these best practices, and then where can we take that? I think there's a lot of open-endedness here in terms of what might be next. A couple of other specifics on that too. One thing I think people have truly not gotten yet is all the different horizons. So I think the next book could be very much, and this is probably where it's going to go, is like, hey, folks, let's talk about the open loop at 20,000 feet and 30,000 feet and 40,000 feet. It's still the GTD process. It's just for those who have ears to hear, let's take this to some of the subtlety that if you don't then address that, the system will start to become dry and flat. And your system will start to flatline if you don't start paying attention to the deeper levels about this. So a lot of it needs to be, and it's a lot of what I did in Roadmap was, if you go to the road, you went to the Roadmap seminar,
yes.
And what I designed in there, everything in there
is
in the book.
It was a much heavier emphasis on the 30,000 foot and higher than I was
because
expected.
If you're trying to figure out, wait a minute, how do I get in control right now? That may be a weekend with your spouse. You know, not emptying your head in an in basket. Now, the truth is 98% of the time, emptying your head in the in basket is going to be the first thing you better do so you can enjoy the weekend with your spouse. So, you know, interestingly, a lot of times we haven't spent as much time on 20 and 30 and 40,000 foot stuff. You know, and the kind of, you know, popular image often of GTD has been, well, you don't deal with priorities like a lot of the other, you know, sort of business gurus do. And I go, well, no, that's not true. We're just dealing with the things that have to have your attention first, and you're going to need a more complex system to manage the most immediate things on your mind. Because the immediate things on your mind are those things wrapped around the ultimately what sift down to 170 moving parts in terms of next steps that are driven by 65 to 95 projects. And those are the things that you need the most complex system to manage, but it's the most mundane stuff that needs the most complexity to get control of it. So we knew that was and we still do, that is the first issue that people have to address. Because people don't just sit down and start writing down 30 and 40,000 foot stuff. Every once in a while you do, especially if it's in crisis mode or you're staring at the offer to take on VP of the new startup, and you're going to have to decide right now a 40,000 foot issue, because that's going to impact, certainly the next 3 to 5 years, if not the rest of your life. And now you're going to have to grapple with that issue. Most people, unless it's that immediately in their face, won't go back to those kinds of things at those different horizons. But if they're there, and they are for a lot of people, most of us, if they're there, you're going to have to pay attention to them. So I think the next iteration of this will be to get people to say, okay, guys, let's take the microscope and let's get it a little sharper so that we can move it in and out to these different levels. So I think a lot of the new messages, this matrix called, well, where do you need to go right now to put your attention? What has your attention? And I think a lot of the new message is, one of the hallmarks out of the roadmap seminar is, if you don't pay attention to what has your attention, it'll take more of your attention than it deserves, or if you don't pay appropriate attention to it. So learning to find out what's got my attention, how do I unhook that? Because it's still the basic truth. It's called, the more it's on your mind, the less it's happening. And so the mind is for having ideas, not for holding them. So learning that education and what we do with that at subtler and subtler levels. So again, long non-answer to your question, Cole, still kind of beats me. But those are the things right now cooking on my brain about what's next here.
I think it's you've got me thinking. It's kind of interesting because I agree with you. I think what initially attracted me to getting things done, and what certainly has attracted a lot of other people, is the very tactical basis of it, if you will, the very bottom up basis of it. That you're not out there saying, I'm going to start out with these big, what I like to call capital letter nouns, and then hoping that all trickles down into my life. In a certain respect, and this goes a little bit off what I talk about on the site, but I think what you're ultimately saying is that if these priorities are truly priorities in your life, the time to think about them is not when you're sitting in front of a telephone. It's at a time when you're making much more strategic decisions about how you want your life to be working. And if you're thinking about these priorities as part of a tactical approach every single morning, you may not actually be getting the things done that you need to be getting done. This is part of it, actually. You know what I'm saying? It's like you need to give this the respect and the time to firewall time to make this part of your process.
Let me bring it down to this. People, let's bring it down to a real nitty-gritty and then back it up to the question you just asked. The real nitty-gritty, and you got a bunch of people on your site, I know, that say, yeah, but David, how do you tie actions to projects? If you don't tie the actions
in that
to
voice,
project,
too, that exact voice.
Exactly. I'm sorry. I'm old and cranky. But, and I hear that so much. I understand the issue. And the real issue is not they're dealing with a symptom, not the problem. The symptom is that they're not looking at their projects appropriately as often as they need to. If they were, anybody who does a thorough weekly review on a regular basis never has that question, ever, that I've ever heard.
Right.
They don't need it. Because if you have to keep thinking about your projects, you're not really thinking about your projects. It's kind of like if you never do a weekly review, you're always doing a weekly review, but not quite. Mm-hmm. So now you've got weekly review on your head all the time because you never finished it. So if you actually sat down and thought about 40,000 feet appropriately, you shouldn't be. When I'm playing with the dog, I don't want to think about my strategic plan. I need to have thought about it. So the whole point of this is, which conversation do you need to have with whom at what horizon so that thing is dealt with responsibly? And that is not every hour, every day to be thinking about your prior. That's why that's so silly.
Yeah.
You just need to have made sure you've had that conversation appropriately that then has rolled down to the things that you need to see. So now I'm at a phone. Let me see the results of having thought through projects on my weekly review, having thought through my job description with my boss every 3 months, having thought through my strategic plan last year, having thought through what I'm doing with my life and having thought through why I'm on the planet at the last spiritual, event that I was at. Let me all roll that down to, if those now come down to, okay, I've now made all the decisions I need about actionable stuff about any of that, I get to a phone and trust that's every single phone call that came out of those thoughts. I don't need to go back to rethink those thoughts. I just need to work off the phone list.
And that just about does it. On behalf of David Allen, David Coe, and myself, I'd like to thank everyone for listening to these podcast episodes. We really hope you enjoyed hearing them as much as we enjoyed doing them. David and I would like to thank Rick Cantor, Robert Peake, and Jeff from Zircon Sky Studios in Ojai for their invaluable assistance in putting all this together. We most definitely could not have done it without them. Finally, I'd like to personally thank David for being so generous with his time and letting me interview him and bug him via email and doing all the needly stuff I had to do trying to put these together for broadcast. I thank him very much. It was a really good time. As ever, please remember that you can learn more about David and getting things done at his company's website, which is located at davidco.com. And do be sure to have a look at his new membership program, GTD Connect, which is also located at gtdconnect.com. I'm Merlin Mann from 43folders.com, and I'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Bye-bye.